In Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado's lab at the Stowers Institute, flatworms grow in big aquarium tanks. Swimming around, they look like squirming specks. But the researcher says he's got a soft spot for them.
Well, once you put them under the microscope and you see their photoreceptors, they look like little, manga characters. They're actually quite cute.
Don't let the cuteness fool you. What's happening here is a big deal. This scientist and his team have figured out how to regenerate dead flatworm cells. Let me say that another way. They are bringing stuff that's dead back to life. It's complicated, and I'm oversimplifying just a tad, but what's happening in this lab is the magical kind of discovery scientists live for. Alejandro knows that.
That's what you do science for. You live for this moment.
Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll hear the story of not just why he does science, but how he became enchanted with the universe, why he left Venezuela and came to the U.S. without knowing any English, and how he came to be regenerating flatworms in the first place. Actually, these days he's working on replicating that success with freshwater fish in his Kansas City lab. By the way, he's just back from the Great Barrier Reef, where he discovered three new species. No big deal. Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
So you're regenerating life in your science lab, and you just casually discovered three new species on vacation. Who lives like that?
I wish more people live like that because the ease of identifying new species arises from the fact that we're not looking very closely at our natural world, at our surroundings, and there are many things that are invisible to us by choice, not necessarily by the fact that they're really difficult to find.
I think many of us assume that everything's already figured out. Like if I see a species I don't recognize, I just assume someone else has recognized it.
It's a fair assumption, but some species are more charismatic than others. So there is a high distribution of known species in things that are attractive to people. But things that are a different scale that require a microscope or some magnifying glass, those are not necessarily things that people look at any level of detail. I ask you, for example, when was the last time you looked very, very closely at the core of an apple, for example, and how the seeds actually sit in the little pockets? And then if you now magnify that and then see the intricate, organization of these structures with each other, it's a completely different way of looking at the apple. So the natural world is a lot like that. There's some parts of it that, for whatever reason, we just don't pay too much attention to.
But you do. So how long does it take you to get through a meal looking at apples like that?
It could take a long time. I am in the habit of not eating lunch because I prefer to spend my hour doing other things. But if I see something that really catches my eye, it's a valley of distraction for me. There's no doubt about that.
Well, so, okay, when I just said earlier that you're regenerating life from a single cell, can you explain that? Because I do think I'm oversimplifying, but how much?
Yeah, it is, you've captured the essence of what, ultimate result of the experiments are. What we're trying to do is to understand how organisms can normally reconstruct themselves after being subjected to the normal wear and tear of daily life. And so what we do is that we exaggerate that by subjecting animals to large dosages of irradiation. The animals are still alive, but they're on their way out. And what we were able to do was to transplant into these organisms that were, fated to die, a single cell that contains all of the information that was required to generate all of the dying cells, eventually restoring those dying cells with healthy cells and bringing the animal back from the brink.
So it's the cells that are being regenerated. The life of the organism is still intact, but the cells have been dying and those cells are regenerated.
That is correct. So one way to think about this, which we normally don't do, is that we have a very binary perception of what's life and death. And I think you start dying from the moment you're born. And
Optimistic.
It's kind of like a reality where you have this progressive continuum of growth and turnover. And when that balance is no longer kept, for example, when we're young, we grow. That means life is outpacing death. When we reach a steady state, at the age you and I are right now, now what you see is that eventually, you know, dying cells will begin to overtake the living cells until eventually, you know.
So in you and me, you think dying cells are surpassing living cells? I'm just having a moment here.
Yeah, you know, you'd be surprised. I mean, somebody calculated a few years ago that we turn over anywhere between 40 to 70 billion cells per day. I mean, this is like American billion. This is not metric billion. This is a 1,000 million. But what that means essentially is that if you do the numbers, in a year, you would have turned over an equivalent number of cells that is identical to your body weight. Just think about that. You lost between yesterday and today about 40 to 70 billion cells. And nonetheless, this morning, you recognize yourself in the mirror. And so to maintain that form and function, that outward appearance we give to the world, this kind of like interplay between dying cells and new cells that are replacing dying cells has to be maintained. And so when we see people age, that's what's happening, is that the number of cells that are dying are outpacing the number of cells that are replacing them. So, you know, we get wrinkles, our muscle begins to get less firm, we begin to accumulate adipose tissue, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a process. It is a continuous process from birth, I would say even before birth, all the way up to when we are no longer here.
Okay, well, that's all of life. So you learned this all, like the experiments you have been doing, and it started with planaria and planaria, which are flatworms.
Yeah.
And then now you're working on replicating it with freshwater fish?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the three species we are looking at closely in the lab right now. We're also looking at a snail. And the reason for doing this is that we have begun to reach a point in our understanding of planarian regeneration that allows us to ask the following question. Are the things that planarians are doing to regenerate missing body parts, are they unique to planarians, or is this something that occurs in other species? And clearly, you know, we want to extrapolate that information to understand our own biology. So we have begun to extend our search into other related and perhaps more distant organisms from planarians to see to what extent these processes are similar or dissimilar from each other. We want to focus on the similarities, because the similarities are the ones that are very likely going to give us insight as to why some animals are really, really good at regenerating missing body parts and why some animals just are not really that good at it.
How good are humans at it?
It depends on the context. I mean, we're really good at regenerating, for example, the lining of our stomach, our esophagus and intestines. But we're not really good at replacing an amputating arm, for example. I mean, that we cannot do. But even though we cannot do that, the things that we do to restore our cells after injury is really astonishing. The surface area of the intestine is about the same area of a tennis court, and that's actually being resurfaced every week.
Like a Zamboni on an ice skating
yes,
rink or something?
That's right. Now imagine that you had to do this on a regular basis. Well, we do it day in and day out, and there's a lot of room for us to make mistakes, and there's a lot of room for us to, like, you know, drop dead like flies. And yet, you know, that does not happen with as much frequency as one would imagine, because there are some very robust systems in our body to maintain that balance between cells that are turning over and cells that are being born to replace them.
It's amazing to me that you look at life on the cellular level. You look at these very small details that are invisible to the eye and organisms that are themselves, in many cases, very small.
Yes.
Planaria have light-sensitive photoreceptors,
yeah,
and not, you know, what we would think of as eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, like, when you talk about these things, you are talking about, like, the big questions of philosophy and what life means and stuff like that. How do you do your work, the detail-oriented work of science, with always, it seems like, I mean, every answer you give gets into these big questions about life and death and all of the opportunities we have to drop dead like flies, and yet our bodies resurface themselves like little Zambonis and things like that. You know, I mean, it's amazing.
No, I agree with you, Gina. That's a really, really good question. I mean, I don't know why I'm, you know, partial to this kind of way of looking at things, but here's how I look at it. I mean, I think that the beauty of the natural world at the scale that we live it in, it's accessible to everybody. Everybody can appreciate, you know, the plumage of a canary. Everybody can appreciate the song of a canary. And everybody can appreciate a rainbow. And so when you begin to ask questions as to how did that come about, how did that beauty come about, and you start changing the scale from what you can see with the naked eye to what you can see with an aided eye using a microscope, and you begin to see the structures that produce this beauty, it doesn't really subtract from it. It actually adds to it. So I find it really a beautiful thing to be able to explain why, you know, you need an angle of diffraction that is just so, such that a rainbow can be produced, or that you need a certain type of pigment to be produced at just the right time in order for the canary plumage to be yellow. And understanding those processes makes our understanding and appreciation of the natural world, I think, much more intimate and much more rewarding. So I don't see scientists as being party poopers. Oh, they're going to demystify everything. I actually see them as individuals that are actually, you know, adding to our understanding and adding to our appreciation of beauty.
When you trace back your own interest in science and the natural world, where do you think it begins?
You know, I think it came about because I had a very, now that I think about it, a fairly privileged upbringing, in the sense that I was moving freely between urban areas and the countryside.
And so, In Venezuela,
that's correct. So I live in a very, I was born and raised in a very large city, large metropolis, which is Caracas, and, you know, full of cars. Of course, it's the tropics, so everything is green, but it's still a city nonetheless. And you could clearly see that we were trying to control the environment so we could have a comfortable life. But my grandfather used to have a cattle ranch in the countryside, and that was as thin a veil of civilization as you can possibly imagine, because nature was really engulfing the ranch all the time, because it was right at the border of the jungle. So things grows out of control, and life was brimming from every corner that you could look at. And just that compare and contrast between the two different contexts really began to make me wonder about, you know, what our place in this ecosystem is. What is it that we can do to further understand these things?
And is there something you remember observing there in particular?
Yeah, so many things, Gina. I mean, it's when you go into a place where the human footprint or fingerprints are not as readily observable, there's all kinds of things going on.
Give me an example.
I'm gonna produce one for you. so I tell you, one of the first things that I became enthralled with was with the fact that our rivers in the ranch were completely infested with piranhas, and we call it infestation because, you know, they're not very friendly to you.
Piranhas.
Yeah,
that's what I've heard about them.
Yeah, exactly. And so, the rate at which these animals can actually devour a animal carcass or a corpse is really astonishing.
And you watched that happening?
Oh, yeah, many times. Because sometimes, you know, cattle will go into the river, and if they had a wound and they were attacked, I mean, that would be the end of that. And so that's what I mean. You know, nature was always trying to get, you know, the upper hand. And so that was one aspect. The other aspect was all the insects and the singing at night of crickets and the butterflies. You know, I remember seeing my first pupa at the ranch and watching through the thin layer of the encasing, you know, what was going to be the wings of this butterfly. And when I realized the butterflies came from these relatively pretty but nonetheless, you know, unheralded, you know, caterpillars, I was mystified by that. How do you go from this into this butterfly is something that really caught my eye as well.
Can you tell me about your family growing up in Venezuela?
Yeah, so I have a younger brother, so we used to get in trouble a lot together, as you can imagine. My father was a hydraulic engineer who later on got involved in politics. He was a congressman for a few years. My mom actually dropped out of high school to have me. She had me when she was very young. But she was always very patient with me and would always try to direct my hyperactivity towards things that I would enjoy doing. So, you know, she would buy me like my chemistry set, pieces to assemble my first microscope, things that would keep me busy and out of trouble. So I owe them a great deal of gratitude for what they did to me, which at the time I really didn't appreciate. Like, you know, like all children usually realize later in life.
What about your schooling? I mean, was there a teacher who took your just basic observing of nature to a more like kind of disciplined, like this is called science kind of place?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I was very lucky to have been exposed and mentored by fantastic teachers in both elementary school and high school. But there's one teacher that I think convinced me that what I wanted to do was biological research. His name was Maldonado, and he had a very unorthodox method of teaching class. First day of class, everyone was afraid of him. Instead of launching onto a tirade of all of the terms we need to learn in biology, he just asked a simple question, which was, you know, if you had to invent a language, what's the minimum number of characters that you would need? And then he sat on his desk and said nothing. And he would not.
This is the first day of class?
First day of class.
Of science class.
Of biology, yes.
And his question is, if you wanted to invent a language, what's the minimum number of characters you need?
Yeah, that's okay. Right. And so we sat there looking at each other, dumbfounded. And one of my friends, who is now a psychiatrist, Nestor, he said, one. And so Professor Maldonado said, well, explain. And so Nestor said, well, let's take the letter A. That's one word. A-A, that's another word. A-A-A, that's another word. Ad libitum. And so it's not the most practical language, but it's a language you can actually, you know, generate a degree of complexity. To which Maldonado said, well, that's right, that's correct. But in life, in nature, actually uses four letters to qualify all of life, which are the four nucleotides that make up DNA, A, C, G, and T. And he told us that every species on the planet would have a collection of A, C, Gs, and Ts in their nuclei, in their cells, that specify what those species were.
What is the, I guess I'm having trouble understanding what the A, C, G, and T are in this metaphor, it sounds
right.
Like.
So let me explain that clearly, because it's a fundamental aspect of what we do today in biomedical research. So there are building blocks, molecules that are used in nature to codify genetic information. And those building blocks are essentially four nucleotides, which are called adenine, hence the A, guanine, G, cytosine for C, and thymidine for T, so ACGT. So whenever people talk about sequencing the human genome or sequencing the genome of an organism, you'll get a string of ACGs and Ts in the billions. And the order in which those ACGs and Ts are organized is the order that encodes the information that will make the proteins, that will make the structures that make you and me and everything else that's alive on the planet.
So there are four, the alphabet of life has four letters.
That's correct, Gina. Yeah. That's really remarkable, isn't it?
And you learned that on your first day of biology?
Pretty much. The first week, that's what we talked about. I mean, so then the next question was, where do they come from? How could they have been possibly been synthesized in, you know, in primeval Earth? And so we took a trip of the history of life from the first day of school all the way to modern genetics by the time we were done the first year. It was a fantastic
class. I want to go to your school.
You know, I wish more schools were like this. I assumed that this was normal. But now as the years go by, I realize how important it is to have, you know, absolutely dedicated and terrific teachers committed to the instruction of young minds. And that really needs to be supported way, way, way more than we may be doing right now.
You know, you mentioned that your father was a congressman when you were a child. There is a lot of political turmoil in Venezuela now. Was that the case when you were growing up?
No, Venezuela was on an upward trajectory at the time. I mean, the future looked really bright, so bright that the optimism was unbridled. We felt that my generation was going to transform the continent, that we had the resources and the wit and smarts to be able to do that.
What time period are we talking about?
We are talking 1970s, 1980s. Those were fantastic years. And I remember growing up in an environment where, you know, we felt that the sky was going to be the limit. And so I heard of, you know, upperclassmen who were leaving the country to study at the grand universities in all over the world. They were coming back and starting new businesses, new ventures. It all looked terrific. And so I was part of that wave. And so I left Venezuela in 1981 in the hopes of becoming a molecular biologist. This is something I could not study in Venezuela. So I came to the U.S. to do that. And so at the time, it was a pretty robust democracy. It had already been 40 years or so of democracy, and so it was a given that that's the system we're going to have from that point onward. Clearly, history had other, you know, surprises in their bag for us.
When you talk about your decision to leave, we'll get back to the politics, but when you talk about your decision to leave being because you couldn't study molecular biology in Venezuela, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, molecular biology was an emerging discipline in the world, and the centers of this activity were in Europe and in the United States. People had just begun to realize how genetic information was codified, how these four letters of the alphabet of life were being used to produce proteins and to produce the complexes of biological molecules that make life possible. And I thought that was absolutely exciting. And we had no such thing in our universities in Venezuela. The career that I would have to be subjected to be able to hopefully do some kind of science would be medicine. But I did not get along with the way medicine is taught. It's a great deal of memorization. I can understand why, but that was not my cup of tea. I wanted to know how the antibiotic worked. I didn't want to know that you use this antibiotic to kill this bacteria. I wanted to know how it killed it. And that was not something that we were allowed to learn in medical school.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is a portrait session with Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado. He's a scientist here in Kansas City, and his research at Stowers is changing things pretty dramatically in the field of biology. We just heard about his childhood in Venezuela. Coming up, what it was like to land in the U.S. without knowing any English, and how he got from that point to where he is now, a principal investigator with his own lab. Stay with us. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado, a biology researcher at Stowers who's got his own lab, a whole staff dedicated to the study of flatworms or planaria. It might not sound all that exciting until I mention that what he's doing with those flatworms is regenerating life to dying cells from a single cell that's been injected into an organism. That's all, just regenerating life to dead cells. Alejandro grew up in Venezuela. He had a happy childhood spent chasing rainbows and looking at the pupas of butterflies. But he left Venezuela to study science in the U.S. Only thing is, he knew no English when he got here, and that is where our story picks up. Hi again, Alejandro.
Hello, Gina.
So, you know, you had a lot of reason, a lot of drive to come study molecular biology in the U.S. Did it ever occur to you, like, to be afraid of going to another country not knowing the language?
Yeah, you know, I guess everybody, you know, would be afraid to change their familiar surroundings. But I don't know. You know, when you're young, you're immortal. You know, you just don't know any better, right? And so I was 16, 17 when I left my country. And
wait, you started college at 16 or 17?
I graduated when I turned 17 the year I graduated. And I came here, I believe, in 1981. And then what I decided to do was that I needed to learn the language. And I felt that, you know, I made a tactical mistake in high school because instead of taking English, I actually took Latin in the hopes that that would help me with science. That just really has not helped me a great deal. English would have been a much more useful thing to do at the time. But, you know, what did I know?
Did you ever, like, in those early days in the United States, as you're a student at a university, not really having a grasp of the language, like, did you ever flash back to that moment where you decided to study Latin?
Oh, I cursed my fate so many times. I mean, it was just, it was an impenetrable language at the time. You know.
And this, you went to Vanderbilt University.
A really
revered institution, whether you're studying in your, and I imagine a challenging school to study at, whether you're in your native language or not.
Yeah, challenging. I didn't realize how big of a challenge it was going to be until after I jumped in the pool and tried to swim. And the only good thing that I did was that first year, I only took classes that would require very little English for me to succeed. So I took chemistry, physics, and math.
Which have their own language.
Had their own language, but you know, if the answers in the test can be written out in numbers or formulas, I was able to do that. But I struggled with English. Of course, English 101 was Shakespearean English. We were talking about Shakespeare, and that was a third language. I mean, that's a completely different way of communicating. And I had a fantastic teacher at the time who gave me a mercy pass, I have to say, because I really tried very, very hard. His name was Professor Cornett. And what he did when he realized that I really lacked any skills in the language, he suggested that I do the following. Grab, you know, the play that we're studying, which at the time was King Lear, go to the library, and then pull out LPs, these vinyl records of the Royal Shakespearean Society, and listen to the play as you read the text. And that began to break the ice in my understanding on the language, because I could now read the text, hear the intonation, and realize that some of the text was supposed to be ironic or sarcastic, or it was done in jest. And so the language became not just a collection of written characters on a page. It became much more alive.
But I noticed that listening to a record, you can't read lips. You can't watch hand gestures and kind of pick up on sort of the context clues of body language to help you. You're without that.
Right. That's the mastery of the actors of the Royal Shakespearean Society. It really became pretty obvious. You could close your eyes and you could imagine where all the characters were standing. If they were close to each other, you could hear maybe a slap on the back, which was written on the text, or you could image it.
But, you know, I have to say, some of what you would learn from Shakespearean English seems to be me like it would be as useless as Latin.
You are not too far from the mark, to be frank with you, because for a while, you know, I spoke Shakespearean English, which was, you know, people just thought
in the 1980s,
yeah, it was
in
crazy.
Tennessee.
Yes, it was not really. It was received with amusement. Let's put it that way. But you know, I tell you, so once I realized that I could really begin to hear the separation between words in the spoken language. One really key thing that helped me was that on my way from where I was staying to work, I would listen to the radio, particularly public radio, and I would listen to the news in the morning. And it was through listening to the radio that I began to understand the differences between Shakespearean English and the English that you and I are speaking this morning.
So you listen, public radio took you from... taught you modern English?
Pretty much. And I liked it because, you know, in many cases, the complexity of the subject matters that were being discussed is, I mean, we're talking about the Reagan years. I mean, the country seemed to be nearing closer and closer to a armed conflict with Russia. I mean, there was a lot of analysis going on. There was a lot of trepidation going on. And all this was being reflected in the news. And it was being explained and processed by what I thought at the time were truly remarkable journalists. And I began to really gain an appreciation of how to take a complex situation and synthesize it into very few words, because, you know, time is a premium in radio, to be able to convey that complexity. So I learned a great deal from just listening to the radio.
Well, that's really cool. But this whole process of learning where you go from knowing no English to sort of muddling through classes that require that you write in numbers only to being instructed to learn Shakespearean English from vinyl records, then kind of modernizing that through NPR, that had to take some time. How did you deal with being in that position of not having a command of the language until then?
Yeah, it was difficult. It was very difficult. I mean, I felt, you know, like I imagine all people who immigrate to a country where they do not dominate the language are fairly isolated. You know, people would talk to me, but I wouldn't understand. I just happened to come from a culture where we really love to make fun of things. So humor helped me a great deal. And so I had a very fast rule in the first couple of years when I was in the U.S. that I could navigate conversations without knowing what the conversations were by using essentially just three expressions. One was, really? That one applies to a lot of things. And then the other one was like, sure. And then the other one was like, of course. And that was good enough for me to like have a conversation that I thought went well without knowing what we were talking about. And so that
I have to try that. Really? Sure. And of course.
It's right. I mean, you can listen to all kinds of conversations, irrespective of the level of complexity. You can always find in the right intonation just to say that. And the speaker thinks that you really are following.
I feel that way about sports and come on.
Yeah, something like that. Exactly.
Like no matter what just happened, come on is
that's
appropriate.
That's exactly right. And so there's always, I mean, that's one beautiful thing about the English language is that you can, embody a great deal of meaning in just one or two words. And so once I was able to feel that even though I was not understanding, but people were talking to me, that gave me an opportunity to really pay attention and really begin to try to understand what they were telling me. Bad is when you don't put yourself out there and nobody talks to you. You feel so isolated that all you're left with is TV or some other means of mass communication, which does not allow for conversation. It's just a one-way street. And the complicated thing for learning a language is being able to be in a two-way street.
So trying to apply all of this to at least passing, if not thriving, in your education at Vanderbilt University, was failure an option?
Yeah, I mean, if I failed, the deal with my father was that I would return to Venezuela and finish medical school. That was the deal. And so I could not fail. I mean, the first year, I had to pass. So that's why I say that my professor in English gave me a mercy pass. I explained to him as best as I could that if I fail this class, I'm going to have to go back and I'm not going to be able to study molecular biology. But the other thing that I forgot to mention, Gina, is that even in that first year, one of my mentors was Dr. Gisela Mossig, who also passed away. And she was an immigrant from East Germany. She fled East Germany on a bicycle and down the hill before the wall was built, and she walked with a limp because she had an accident. The East German soldier shot at her, and she was walking with a limp. So for whatever reason, she took a liking to me. So she brought me into her lab and put up with my inability to speak, and then allowed me to do things in her lab.
How do you think that someone like her picked up on your potential when you couldn't speak it?
Now that I'm on the other side of the equation, I realized that what she did was deliberate. It was not an accident. She could have picked any other student who was probably much better suited to the task than I was because I had the complication of the language. But that's not what she did. So I learned from her that you look for potential. And then if this individual is demonstrating an appetite for achieving excellence, then you just have to help him out. Yeah.
How did you get interested in flatworms, planaria? They are tiny organisms with very basic light-sensitive photoreceptors for eyes. It's not like becoming fascinated with a majestic bird. The wow factor isn't obvious.
No, it's not. I mean, planarians were a consequence of a process of elimination. I've been fascinated for many, many years now by the process of regeneration. How do organisms restore missing body parts after injury or amputation? I think that's one of the last wild frontiers of developmental biology. We know very little about it, and there's much, much more to have to study and to understand. And so planarians came about through a process of about 1 year where I spent a great deal of time perusing and living in the great libraries of knowledge in this country. And I remember I still have a piece of paper which has this phylogenetic tree of relationships of organisms. And I asked which of these groups of animals has regeneration manifested obviously and exaggeratedly in their biology. And so through this process of elimination, I narrowed down on flatworms. What they do is being called witchcraft by many predecessing generations of biologists, and it's really astonishing what these organisms do. So,
I'm curious, as you continued studying planaria and you have a lab in Kansas City at the Stowers Institute dedicated to this study of regeneration. When was there a moment when you knew you were onto something? Can you take it? Because your big discovery, is there a moment, or is it not like that? Because I like to picture a scientist in a lab coat with like a eureka.
Yeah, you know, there are times when that is the case. And there are times where the eureka may take decades. So it's a very slow eureka. It's not the quick eureka, right? But there was one moment that was preceded by another one when I realized that we were onto something. And this happened when I was in Baltimore. I had just started my own lab at the Carnegie Institution of Washington. And I had a neighbor whose name is Andy Fire. And he had just reported to the Institute that he had discovered that when you take two molecules of RNA and you inject them into an organism, that those molecules could actually affect gene function, essentially causing a defect. You know, I used to tease him all the time. I used to tell him, oh, that's an artifact. That's I don't know what you're doing, but that's probably something that is not true, blah, blah, blah. Well, I mean,
why did you think that wasn't true?
Because what we knew at the time of the biology of RNA and genetics, it didn't add up. The thing is that he discovered something really, really new. So new that he went on to win the Nobel Prize and I went on to eat crow for a long time, okay? But when he discovered this mechanism, I thought like, well, that's what I need to perturb the function of genes in this little flatworm that I'm working with. And if I can do that, then I can ask, what does this gene do the process of regeneration?
I'm sorry to make you back up
on
science to this really this level, but what is RNA? Because people have heard of DNA, but RNA, it's related, but different.
Thank you, Gina. No, that's right. So RNA is ribonucleic acid. And what that is the molecule that transmits the message to the cell that is codified in the DNA. So it's an intermediary. It's like a messenger that, you know, essentially copies a message from the DNA, takes it to somewhere else in the cell where that message is now transformed into protein. That's RNA. It plays a very fundamental role.
It's like the zip drive.
Yes, sort of. That's right. So like a thumb drive. You're moving from one place to another, transmitting information and transforming that information into something useful to the cell. And so that's what RNA was supposed to do. But this new function of RNA, being able to affect that gene function, was completely unknown. So that was a moment. So
as you're eating crow, you're like, but wait, this could
that's
help
right.
me.
This could help me a great deal.
I was wrong, but the upside is.
That's right. The upside is that, like all scientists, you know, whenever we get new data, we will change our mind. And so we are not necessarily married to a particular dogma if we can help it. And we are willing to change our minds if there is robust and unambiguous evidence suggesting that your favorite idea happens to be wrong.
But as you took the new information and started working on it in your lab, and I should say, I guess, labs plural, because at some point you came to Kansas City and started working on this here.
Mm-hmm.
When did the evidence or the results that you gathered tell you that, yes, this idea that you had, the eureka moment, like, this is really happening? I'm really regenerating dead cells within a living organism by injecting RNA.
Yeah, so this was, I would say it was 1998, when we saw a way to go into the biology of the animal and perturb it in predictable ways such that we can determine what the roles of certain components may or may not be. And this happened about 3 a.m, being in the microscope, everybody was gone for the day, and I'm looking at these animals after this RNA was injected into them, and I realized that the injection of that RNA had actually perturbed and damaged a particular tissue type, which was the muscle. So this was a molecule that I injected to prevent the formation of muscle during regeneration. And when I saw that, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it so much that I actually called my then postdoctoral scientist colleague, Phil Newmark.
At 3 a.m.
And, you know, he's married with a young daughter. And then he realized that I wouldn't call him if it wasn't important. He comes in. And then he sits before the microscope for about an hour looking at it. And then he confirms that that what I had seen was very likely true. And that was a really, really momentous time for us.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Today's show is a portrait session with Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado. He's a groundbreaking scientist at the Stowers Institute with a life journey that brought him to the U.S. from Venezuela in the early 80s. We just heard about his big Eureka moment. In a minute, what's going on in his lab right now? We'll be back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado with us from the Stowers Institute. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So you made this huge scientific breakthrough with flatworms where you figured out how to use a single cell to regenerate these creatures, not the creatures themselves, I should say, to regenerate their cells, which had been dying. Can you describe what that looks like? Because what I picture is totally crazy.
Yeah, well, I don't blame you because it really sounds extraordinary. And I think it is, but this is nature at work. We don't give nature enough credit for how extraordinary it truly is. So essentially what happens is that, cells that are dying really are on a one-way street. They are going to die. And when they die, they're going to leave a vacuum. They're going to leave an emptiness where they were before. And if that emptiness is not filled up again with vibrant new cells, the organism will die. And so what this injected cell does, which is truly astonishing, is that it will actually proliferate. It'll divide multiple times. And its daughter cells will actually go on to where those dying cells were and replace them and essentially take over their jobs.
But what do you see with your eye?
What you see with your eye is a very small sphere with a few processes coming out from its edges, trying to feel its surrounding.
Wiggling your fingers.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing because that's what the processes look like. They're just like wiggling like this. And then what happens is that something that we don't understand at all, remarkable happens. These cells somehow read information from their surroundings to activate a process that will allow them to proliferate, produce daughter cells, and drive those daughter cells to restore the dying cells' role and function and the life of the organism. This is really a remarkable thing.
You know, so this is not your only discovery. As I mentioned earlier in the show, you're just back from a trip to the Great Barrier Reef where you discovered three new species. How did that happen?
Well, this is a remarkable thing. You know, we think that at least one of the three species that we saw, they're probably novel. They're not being studied by science. The other two we're still waiting for the sequencing to determine. But by morphology, they look quite different. And it's happened in the most, I would say, unglamorous way. Like most things in life, you know, if you really take the time to and pay attention to where you're at and what you're doing, you'll be surprised. So we were walking on the low tide in the Great Barrier Reef, which allows us to not necessarily dive, but actually just walk through the sand across the reef.
Who's we?
Oh, we is the colleague who invited me
to
come visit Australia. This is Bernie Degnan. He's a faculty member at the University of Queensland.
Okay, and you're walking around.
We're walking around, and he says, well, let's lift this rock right here and see what's underneath. He's just showing me. We lift it up. And we find at least four or five different species of tunicates. These are like squirt fish. You'll have to look them up in Google. Just type tunicate.
Squirt fish. Okay.
Yeah. And then you'll see them. They're gloriously beautiful. They live as colonies. They live as solitaries. There's all kinds of forms and shapes. But these organisms are, you know, phylogenetically very closely related to us. Their genome is very similar to our genome. And we found two of them that, you know, Bernie, who's from Australia or has lived in Australia for a long time, had not seen before. I noticed another thing that really caught our eyes, which is something called a bryozoan, which I would suggest you also Google up because it's hard to describe. But these organisms are essentially made out of individual organisms to give rise to one organism. So it poses the question as to what is an individual or not. And so for that, we have some sequence, and we know that that is very likely an undescribed species of bryozoan. And it only took us 1 hour. I mean, look, this is not that we're really lucky. This is that there is an abundance of the unknown out there and that not many of us are taking the time to seek it out and try to understand it. And my suspicion is that each and every one of these species are the consequence of millions of years of experimentation by nature to produce that biology. And they are immense mysteries there that we need to understand.
Okay, so we've all heard the story of Newton, like the apple falls on his head, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the kind of story you typically hear about scientific discovery now. It all happens in the lab.
Right.
But then you're telling this story that seems a little bit more like Newton and the apple.
In that sense, yes. I think that it used to be, Gina, that we scientists had to control the environment so much such that we could extract information from nature that we invented laboratories. And so to study something in the laboratory, you need to bring that life into the lab, domesticate it in some fashion such that you could study it. Technology has moved forward so rapidly that now it is really conceivable and it's possible to bring the lab back to nature, such that we can now look at life in its proper, you know, environment, where it actually was chiseled, where it actually interacts with other things, and it will provide us with a much clearer vision of what is it to be, you know, a particular species surrounded by other species and interacting with other environmental cues to produce the biological activities that we really know very little about.
Well, speaking of taking the scientist out of the lab, you know, I've heard about what's been going on in your lab lately, but you're also, I understand, like, you're a father and you have a family. You have a life outside the lab. How does the life you live when you're studying life affect your actual life? Because you bring so much philosophy to science, it's hard for me to imagine it doesn't go the other way, too.
Yeah, you know, I'm very lucky. You know, my spouse, my wife, is also a scientist. And so I feel very privileged to be able to, you know, have these kinds of conversations with her. And we have a very different approach to doing science, which always reminds me that there is no one way to do great science.
What is her way?
Her way is she's very focused. She's very analytical. And she's very good at bringing a great deal of known information together in new different ways. And so her discoveries are usually the result of great scholarship and a lot of reading and discussion. I, on the other hand, you know, take a less granular approach. I take a much, you know, fish-eye approach, so to speak. So I try to look at not individual components, but at groups of components and then see how they interact with each other. And it's fun. It's fun to have these discussions with her. And this spills over into her family to the point, I think, that some of her children, just, I mean, both of them, they just don't want to talk about science anymore. And so my son is going to be the humanist in our family. He's studying history and he's studying music at the Oberlin Conservatory and loving it. And we're very happy for him. And our daughter still, you know, has one more year of high school. So we'll see what she'll do.
When you go places like the Great Barrier Reef, is your family a part of that?
It depends. So I took my daughter to the Galapagos 2 years ago, for example, and we were there for a week, and she has a keen eye for identifying species. For many summers, for the past 5 years, we spent it at the Marine Biological Laboratories in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and our children came with us, and they were actually course assistants. They would actually go and collect animals for the students to work. So I would tell my daughter, Annika, I need some tinophores and some parhyella, go and collect them. And of course, the students laugh, ha, ha, ha. An hour later, she comes back with a bucket with all of those organisms, and then everybody's face is like, what? But that, you know, that's a part of
our life.
That
also sounds like fun.
It is fun.
Go out into the ocean and get some fish. That's not an errand I ever got sent on. Drugstore or something.
Yeah. And then both of them helped me. I've been prospecting the waters of the Vineyard Sound for 5 years now, and they usually come with me on the boat and then help me, you know, record, you know, data. And we have a good time together. Yeah.
When we started this conversation, I was asking you about the flatworms, and you went into this sort of poetic reflection about how we're dying from the minute we're born and how we think of it in a very binary way about life and death when actually we're sort of on this continuum. And I would think that as a parent, you know, that perspective on life, that's interesting to me. How, you know, how do you see, like, I'm going to get philosophical on you, but like how do you see like what life is as a person?
Yeah, you know, I think the way I see it, just to put it in a little package, is that we are, as a species, one of the best ways that life has to know itself. So whether you do this as a scientist, or you do this as an artist, or you do this as anything that you choose to do, it is actually a beautiful thing to think about.
Our time is up, but Alejandro Sanchez Alvarado, thank you so much for spending this time with me today.
Well, thank you very much, Gina, for having me in your program. I really appreciate it.
I'm going to look at things closely and try to discover some new species.
Wonderful. Let me know if you do.
Alejandro is an investigator at the Stowers Institute for Medical Research, and this is a portrait session, so the story he's told about his life in science will be accompanied online by photographic portraits by the very talented Paul Andrews. He is Central Standard's portrait session partner. It is Friday, so we're headed off for the weekend, and next week we'll actually be on holiday, but never fear, we are playing our favorite conversations from 2018, so it'll be best of week here on KCUR's Central Standard. From our interview with the Kansas native, who was a National Book Award finalist this year, to the story of a sunken steamboat that turned up underground, stuck in mud in the middle of Missouri. So tune in next week. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. I also want to acknowledge the contributions made by ace journalist Jen Chen through the course of this year. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Linda Scherer runs the board for us, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs.